program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And our first article today is Mural Unveiled at St. Patrick's Cathedral Sends a Message on Immigration. This was written by Fiona Murphy for the Religion News Service. A 25-foot mural at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan, unveiled last week and blessed during Sunday Mass of September 21st, honors generations of immigrants to New York, taking on a new meaning in today's political climate. "Some have asked me, are you trying to make a statement about immigration?" said Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, during a press conference on Thursday. "Well, sure we are." The mural, "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding," was 2 years in the making and spans the three-wall entrance of the 146-year-old cathedral. Created by Brooklyn-based painter Adam Sivjanovic, it features life-size, realistic portraits of Irish immigrants fleeing famine in the 19th century, alongside contemporary Latino, Asian, and Black immigrants, shown with backpacks and determined expressions. Mother Frances Cabrini, the first American citizen to be canonized and the patron saint of immigrants, is depicted among them. Reporters from across New York and the United States crowded into St. Patrick's on Thursday to snap photos of the new mural, a rare art commission for the historic cathedral. It comes as crackdowns on immigration and deportation raids have swept across the country as ordered by the Trump administration. Many people living in New York, a city home to millions of immigrants, wonder about the future of their communities. Dolan's mother, Shirley Jean Radcliffe Dolan, is captured in the painting among the Irish immigrants, though it was Dolan's great-grandparents who arrived to New York from Ireland. "That was a surprise to me," Dolan said to reporters. "If you can't pick her out, she's the one with the Saks Fifth Avenue bag and the bottle of Jameson in that bag." One of the panels on the Fifth Avenue side wall portrays five New York City first responders with an angel holding a firefighter's helmet above them. Another shows historic Catholic leaders such as Archbishop John Joseph Hughes, the first Archbishop of New York, who initiated the construction of St. Patrick's Cathedral, Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, Pierre Toussaint, the Haitian-born philanthropist and former slave buried in the cathedral's crypt, and Kateri Tekawitha, the first Native American saint. Dolan said the commission was inspired by the apparition at Knock, an apparition of Mary reported in County Mayo, Ireland, in 1879, a location the Archbishop has visited numerous times. "Immigrants are children of God," Dolan said during the press conference. "The people of Israel in the Old Testament and the people formed by Jesus Christ have been challenged to always be warm and embracing for the immigrants. So, the fact the church would mirror that, no surprise at all." Dolan has criticized anti-immigrant rhetoric and echoed support of the Catholic Church's ministry to migrants, although he has seemingly maintained a cordial relationship with President Donald Trump. The Cardinal sits on the National Religious Liberty Commission, which Trump established earlier this year. If we look at the people in the pews in daily Mass, most people are immigrants, the Reverend Enrique Salvo, the rector of St. Patrick's Cathedral, told Religious News Service. "Therefore, we have to see the dignity of the human person in everyone. No matter what the political viewpoints are, that we put them aside when we are encountering one-on-one. Sivjanovic, a self-taught painter from Massachusetts known for creating large historical landscapes, said that although the mural's concept predates today's political battles over migration, he is glad it speaks to the present moment. We didn't know that this was going to happen quite like this, Sivjanovic said, but now I feel truly grateful to be able to take a stand about it and to give a place where people who are being told that they don't belong, that they belong. In the mural, streams of gold leaf oil paint fall down from the heavenly realm onto those below, all of whom were modeled from real people. Even the Lamb of God, painted as a small lamb on the south wall to depict Jesus, was drawn based on a lamb in New Jersey, Sivjanovic said. Raised in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, Sivjanovic was inspired by his own religious background for the mural style, he said. Golden icon screens from the Byzantine church, which separated altars from congregations, have a clear influence on the piece. The Eastern church influence is there, buried in it, translated into my interpretation of Catholic tradition and my interpretation of what New York needed right at the moment, Sivjanovic said. The mural incorporates more than 5,000 sheets of gold. Sivjanovic said that today he practices his faith through his art. The painting is a devotional act, he said. That's how I pray, through paint. Kevin Conway, vice chairman of a global equity firm and the principal donor behind the mural, said he hopes New Yorkers see themselves reflected in the cathedral's entrance. On a very pedestrian level, it is a wild improvement over what was here before, Conway told Religion News Service. I could spend a day looking at that panel. My great-grandparents were immigrants, came over with nothing. In response to one of the final questions at the press conference, Dolan emphasized the ambition of the cathedral's new entrance. It's a city, a nation, a world that seems to be tortured by violence and vitriol and misunderstanding and death that's going on, he said. And so many people have said, hey, we really needed this, some light on the situation. That light, Salvo said, is also a roadmap of the immigrant journey in New York. We have that gift and that legacy from the generations of the past that lived suffering and made the best out of it, Salvo told Religion News Service. Now, we in present generations have the same invitation and responsibility to do the same. Our second story, Rosh Hashanah helps us envision a Judaism beyond nationalism, written by Andrew Kahn. As anti-Semitism, Zionism, and Judaism continue making daily headlines, I frequently find myself in conversations about what it means to be Jewish. The conflict in Gaza has generated a slurry of confusion about Judaism, anti-Judaism, Zionism and anti-Zionism, and led to utter chaos with regard to perceptions of Jews by Jews and by others. Jews are being pressed to define who we are, how we belong, and what responsibilities we carry. The holiday of Rosh Hashanah offers a vital place to begin. Other Jewish holidays focus on ancient Israelite history. Rosh Hashanah is universal. It celebrates the creation of the universe and humanity. Its prayers describe God as the judge of all life, not only for Jews. The Jewish story is, it tells us, a story about the whole world. This emphasis on the universal is especially important, as much of the Jewish discourse in America has become consumed by ethno-nationalism. Jewish nationalism, or Zionism, is said by some to be inseparable from Judaism itself. Others, myself included, look to the kind of Jewish universalism found in Rosh Hashanah, as a call to resist nationalism's exclusionary and often supremacist logic. The debate itself is rooted in rich theological and historical questions. What does it mean for Jews to be chosen? And how did the modern concept of Jewish peoplehood arise from that idea? The notion of Jews as chosen by God has been interpreted over the centuries as divine favoritism, as a burden, as an aspirational motivation to model justice. Accordingly, Jews have celebrated chosenness as a gift or discarded it as an outdated relic that invited resentment and arrogance. But at its core, chosenness has been about covenant. Jewish teachings and practices, or Torah, provided tools to connect to the divine and humanity's highest aspirations. Jews, born or by choice, were chosen by choosing to take on the commitments of Torah. In the mid-20th century America, the new idea of Jewish peoplehood was popularized by rabbis Mordecai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, and Stephen S. Wise, a major shaper of Reform Judaism. This described Jews as an ethnic collective, and in doing so it adopted the ideas of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis' American Zionism. In a 1915 speech, Brandeis said, "A man is a better citizen of the United States for being also a loyal citizen of his state. Every Irish American who contributed toward advancing home rule in Ireland was a better man and a better American for the sacrifice he made. Every American Jew who aids in advancing the Jewish settlement in Palestine, though he feels that neither he nor his descendants will ever live there, will likewise be a better man and a better American for doing so." The new language of peoplehood proved enormously successful. It embodied Brandeis's goal of making Jewish difference legible to the American mainstream as a European-style national people with a singular history, language, and land. This was attractive in an era when European Jewish immigrants sought to integrate into white ethnic America, while strengthening ideological ties to the emerging state of Israel. But what was actually on offer was a chosenness remodeled into ethno-national exceptionalism. Kaplan's basic premise was, as he wrote in his 1955 book, A New Zionism, rooted in the persistence in the Gentile consciousness of Jews as an identifiable group. The problem with this ideology is that it smuggled into the very heart of Jewish identity a belief central to the most virulent anti-Semitic views, that Jews are united as a singular global group with shared nationalist goals. It also flattened the immense diversity of Jewish cultures into a nationalist identity consistent with European, generally Ashkenazi, Judaism. Building on this premise, Kaplan reframed Judaism as a non-creedal religious civilization centered in loyalty to the body of the Jewish people throughout the world. In The Religion of Ethical Nationhood, written in 1970, he made this more explicit. Judaism has pioneered in adumbrating man's potential in achieving that collective religious experience which can motivate men and nations to achieve ethical nationhood. Peoplehood became a powerful framework. It not only gave American Jews a sense of unity, but provided a narrative linking the Holocaust to the State of Israel. Jews were a people nearly destroyed, now restored in their land. It dovetailed neatly with American exceptionalism, casting the U.S. as the rescuer of Jews and the guarantor of Israel, and Israel as the unifying thread linking all Jews. Israel became the necessary homeland for the Jews and support for Israel became the litmus test of belonging. Those who dissent are often accused of betraying the Jewish people. But this framework distorts Jewish history. For most of Jewish existence, there was no unified Jewish people. Jews have lived and thrived heterogeneously in places as widespread as Aleppo, Masada, Addis Ababa, Baghdad, Sana'a, and Cochin, each with distinct practices, customs, and self-understandings. They often disagreed sharply with one another and rarely imagined themselves as a single homogeneous nation. Instead of nationalism, Jewish collectivity was mythopoetic, a spiritual understanding of covenant via Torah, which expressed itself in many differing and often mutually exclusive forms throughout the world. Rosh Hashanah reminds us of this historical reality. On this holiday, Jews do not celebrate the birth of a single people, but the creation of the world. The image is expansive. Every creature passes before the Creator. Every being is judged. Every life matters. That vision undercuts the narrowness of a falsely homogenizing peoplehood. It reminds us that the Jewish story is bound up in the story of all humanity, as Jews have dwelled among all humanity. Torah is a wisdom tradition carried on in Jewish form and meant to be tested, adapted, shared, and lived out in relationship with the rest of the world. Jewish texts echo this universalism. Classical rabbinic midrash teaches that the Torah was offered to all nations. The medieval rabbinic giant Maimonides wrote to a convert that Abraham's lineage is spiritual, not genetic. These perspectives affirm what Rosh Hashanah proclaims, that Jewish distinctiveness is real insofar as it complements the distinctiveness of each facet of the whole of humanity. In her 1991 feminist classic, Standing Again at Sinai, Judith Plaskow critiques the patriarchal notion of chosenness and sees Jewish identity as one thread in a wider tapestry. Within the Jewish community, diversity is a divine guide to connecting with the non-Jewish world. Jews are called to live fully as themselves and as Jews, always in relation to others, always as part of a larger human ecosystem. Judith Butler and their 2013 book Parting Ways develops the idea of unchosenness, arguing that Jews live in irreversible heterogeneity. Jewish identity arises precisely from the fact that we do not choose our neighbors, our histories, or our vulnerabilities. In this, we are inescapably bound to others who are different from us. Diaspora is not a problem to be solved through nationalism, Butler says. It is the essence of Jewish ethical life. To be Jewish is to practice responsibility amid difference, to learn how to cohabitate in a world we share. Plaskow and Butler, taken together, offer a vision of Judaism that resonates deeply with the spirit of Rosh Hashanah. They move us beyond exceptionalism toward interdependence. They remind us that Jewish flourishing requires many communities locally grounded, engaged with Torah, and committed to justice with their neighbors. This is not an abandonment of Jewish identity. On the contrary, it is a recovery of Judaism's richest strands. The idea of the Jewish people as a unified nation is a modern invention. Jewish flourishing has happened best in conversation with neighbors and by applying ethical practices to daily life. Rosh Hashanah's universalism calls us back to this truth. All humanity shares one origin. All life stands before one Creator. If we truly believe this, then the Jewish task is to defy nationalism and live out Torah's wisdom in ways that build solidarity and justice across boundaries. This year, as Jews around the world gather for Rosh Hashanah, I invite us to let go of myths that no longer serve us. Let us question whether peoplehood is the foundation we want. Let us reclaim Judaism, a Judaism that is at once particular and universal, distinct and connected, local and global. May we not strive to be a singular people above others, but communities among communities, committed to the flourishing of all life. Now our third story, religious freedom for psychedelic users, not without indigenous truth. This is an opinion piece written by Christine McCleave for Religion News Service. The recent controversy over an Episcopal priest who was dismissed for promoting psychedelics for spiritual awakening raises urgent questions about how organized religion in America relates to psychedelics. The debate has focused on the safety of these drugs and church authority and doctrine, while ignoring indigenous Americans' long history with such medicines and the church's long painful history of suppressing them. Concerns about priests and others becoming psychedelic shamans are valid. Ordination does not grant medical or cultural expertise, and clergy are not automatically qualified to lead plant medicine ceremonies. Indigenous communities, on the other hand, hold deep intergenerational knowledge of these medicines, rooted in protocols of respect and responsibility. Without a similar foundation, even well-meaning Christian leaders indeed risk causing harm. And it makes sense to regulate those who promote psychedelics. Yet the question remains, how will organized religion engage with psychedelics without perpetuating appropriation and erasure of indigenous people? For centuries, Christian institutions, the Episcopal Church included, criminalized, demonized, and worked to eradicate indigenous traditions that relied on these medicines, even as they thrived by absorbing pagan practices to attract members. Their attempts now to consider or adjudicate practices so long associated with indigenous spirituality betray theological contradictions and spiritual hypocrisy. For over a decade, I have researched the harm caused by church-run Indian boarding schools on Native children in the U.S., institutions designed to erase language, culture, and ceremonies, leaving deep scars of post-traumatic stress disorder and other trauma that still affect our communities today. My research showed that these traumas were intentional, rooted in the belief that indigenous spirituality was a threat to be eliminated. These same abuses were perpetuated around the globe, particularly in the Brazilian Amazon, where the psychedelic substance ayahuasca originates. For communities still healing from church-run attempts to erase language and ceremony, sudden clerical enthusiasm for psychedelics can reopen wounds rather than build trust. Legally, much of the wider debate about the spiritual use of psychedelics turns on religious freedom. Many advocates of psychedelics favor the Religious Freedom Restoration Act model, in which groups seek exemptions for sacramental use. These pathways rely on legal grounds first carved out by indigenous peoples whose traditions were explicitly targeted by federal bans. Today's religious freedom advocates include syncretic Brazilian Ayahuasca churches operating in the U.S., such as the União do Vegetal and Santo Daime, and a growing number of self-described psychedelic churches whose attorneys petition the Drug Enforcement Administration for Religious Freedom Restoration Act exemptions. What they are pushing for through court orders or Drug Enforcement Agency recognition is narrow but powerful: the right to import, possess, and administer otherwise prohibited sacraments, such as ayahuasca, DMT, and sometimes psilocybin, or mescaline, as religious exercise. The RFRA strategy began with a legal case brought by two Native American church members who were denied unemployment benefits after being fired for sacramental peyote use. In the resulting 1990 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Employment Division versus Smith, the justices held that neutral, generally applicable laws could apply to religious practice without violating the First Amendment. In short, the legal door newer groups now walk through was opened by struggles over peyote for Native Americans. That history also reveals a double standard. Indigenous spiritual practices involving peyote or other medicines continue to face stigma, legal barriers, and threats to their supply. This reversal of justice benefits new psychedelic religions, while tribal nations in the U.S. remain vulnerable despite treaty rights and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. Today, psychedelics are being recognized as tools for spiritual renewal, but for indigenous peoples, they are not new frontiers or experimental sacraments. They are living traditions that survive generations of suppression. The church should honor this legacy. True healing will not come from adopting what was once condemned, but from mending relationships and respecting the knowledge of those who kept those traditions alive. If Christianity genuinely wants to engage with psychedelics, it must repent. It needs to confront its history of suppressing indigenous spiritual practices and take concrete steps toward reconciliation. This includes recognizing the origins of those medicines, supporting indigenous sovereignty and conservation, and centering indigenous voices in discussions about law, theology, and practice. Anything less risks repeating history, not as healing, but as another chapter of colonial exploitation. The author Christine Dindisi McCleave, a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Ojibwe tribe, who holds a PhD in Indigenous Studies, is the former CEO of National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. The views expressed in this commentary do not necessarily reflect those of the Religion News Service. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.